It's 12 minutes after 2 o'clock in St. Louis, Missouri, and all throughout the central time zone of these United States. Hello, my name is Paul Harris. Thank you for listening. Thank you for helping to spread the word about a different kind of talk radio for people who never thought they'd listen to talk radio. That's what we do every weekday afternoon from 2 until 6 here on News Talk 1120 KMOX and worldwide on the internet with our streaming audio on KMOX.com. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving weekend. I know I did. Welcome back. Here we go to No Turkey Leftovers for Goodness Sake Day. Please. Aaron Barnhart will be back also. He's our TV guy from TVBarn.com and writes about television for the Kansas City Star. Got a regular weekly segment. He's back this afternoon. Also, going to talk to the author of a new study about kids and sports. You'd be surprised, I think, at the number of kids who admit that they cheat at sports, that they have tried to hurt an opponent at sports. Coaches who have urged their players to do that. I talked to an UMSL professor who put this study together, a study of over 800 student-athletes in this country, kids between the ages of 9 and 15. Talk about causes, solutions, and all that sort of stuff, and include your phone calls in that. I also got a post-Thanksgiving song from the Paul Harris Band, and lots more all to do this afternoon here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. In 1993, Diane Diamond was working for a now-defunct TV show called Hard Copy when she was assigned to report on the Michael Jackson case, the first Michael Jackson child molestation case, the one that we all know turned into a multi-million dollar settlement for the accuser and his family. 10 years later, she was back on the case as an investigative journalist when Michael Jackson actually ended up in court. That court case was yet another one of those California celebrity trials where the guy was found not guilty, even though we all had written guilty down on our little jury forms. She now writes about having worked on the Michael Jackson cases for the last more than a dozen years in a brand new book called Be Careful Who You Love. I'm happy to welcome Diane Diamond to KMOX. How are you this afternoon?
Oh, thanks for having me. I love your music.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
My toes were tapping there waiting to get on.
I'm glad you like that.
Yeah.
Before we talk about the actual case itself, how many times has your life been threatened by Michael Jackson fanatics?
How many fingers and toes times 100, I guess. You know, every time I do a story that they don't want to hear, you know, negative things about their idol, then, you know, they get on the email, they call me up at work, they find my home phone number somehow and let me know, you know, they're unhappy.
Who's they?
Well, that's a really good question. Are they just weird, self-motivated fanatics, or are they somebody working for Team Jackson? Or, you know, I tend to think it's probably the first, just young people especially, who just adore this guy. And they don't want to hear anything negative, and I must be the devil incarnate to them.
Yeah, I think you must be to them. Yeah. And it surprised me as a person who had no interest in this case whatsoever, wasn't covering it, just kind of talking about it on a casual basis here on my show. I was always shocked by these people who were 100% positive this guy couldn't possibly have done anything wrong.
Yeah, you know, when the court case started in Santa Maria, California, like it was arraignment time, there were fans all around outside, and I went and tried to interview them, and I said, you know, why are you here? How can you be so sure that he isn't guilty? I mean, pedophiles are our next door neighbors and our aunts and uncles and scoutmasters and priests, and oh no, he just can't be. They are absolutely convinced that he cannot possibly have done this. And, of course, the jury said he's not guilty. So
now, while we're talking about all of this and the way people responded to you, I got to bring up the name Anthony Pelicano. Who is he and what's his role in your story?
Well, Anthony Pelicano was Michael Jackson's private detective back in 93 and 94. And the minute I started reporting on Jackson back then, I was the first one to break the story of why were the police at his door, child molestation suspicions. Anthony Pelicano just became a tormentor to me. And my phone was tapped, and I don't say maybe, I'm saying it was tapped. The FBI has a case against him now. I think there'll probably be an indictment this week on federal wiretapping charges. So they told me, your phone was tapped. I said, well, I always suspected that. My phone was tapped. My home was burglarized. I worked at Hard Copy, which was on the Paramount Pictures lot. That's got a lot of security, the big Paramount gates. I would park inside those gates, and my car was still broken into, and Michael Jackson documents taken. So it was a really heady time. I would leave work before they let me park inside in the lot, and I'd be surrounded by fans. You know, first it was four fans, and then it was the next day it was eight fans, and then 50 fans, and then I said, you know, I can't park in that garage across the street anymore.
It's not like you were out there speculating. You were essentially just reporting on this. I mean, I know you were called on for your opinion here and there, but for the most part, they were upset because you were reporting on this. Now, let's talk about him and his mindset. Is it possible, Diane, that Michael Jackson thinks he never did anything wrong, that all of this stuff that he did with these boys through all of these years was truly innocent fun in his mind?
Absolutely. In his mind, I know that he thinks that. I mean, he has said as much himself and through, you know, his spokespeople. I will also refer you to a chapter in the book. Ken Lanning was the FBI profiler of pedophiles. He's since retired, unfortunately, but he told me long ago, and I always kept it in my mind, that's what pedophiles think. Now, again, Jackson was found not guilty, but that is what pedophiles think, that they're not doing anything wrong. They're loving that child. They're bringing joy to that child by giving them gifts and cuddling them tight in bed at night.
And that's exactly how he presented himself on that Martin Bashir special a couple of years ago, the one that I think got him into more trouble than all of this other stuff.
Right.
Was the Bashir special the thing that made the Santa Barbara DA really go hard after him?
You know, I actually know a lot of the people in that district attorney's office, and I've known them for 15 years. They didn't even watch it. They were not even aware of it. And then all of a sudden, it sort of exploded, and they got a copy of it, and they watched it, and it took them 3 weeks after they located the family to get the family in to tell them, okay, what happened? I mean, did anything bad happen? And the kid just sort of crumbled. We saw a video of it during the trial, crumbled, and this whole story came falling out of his mouth when he started talking to police detectives.
What was the courtroom like? The thing wasn't completely televised, so we couldn't see what was going on around you and the others who were sitting there. What was the atmosphere in there amongst the gallery, if you will?
Well, there were no cameras allowed in the courtroom, and it was a pretty good-sized courtroom for being such a small area, Santa Maria, California. There was a bad bus crash there yesterday, I noticed. But anyway, it was a pretty small courtroom, a pretty good-sized courtroom, I mean, sometimes a very small crowd. In the beginning, there were lots of people, and the fans were clamoring to get in, but as the 4.5 months went by, fewer and fewer people came, and I mean spectators and reporters. I was there every day for 4.5 months, but always his mother was there. Sometimes his brothers and his father would come. The sisters, Latoya, Janet, and the older one, Rebe, only came for arraignment and for the verdict. So it was sort of the same core people in there every day, and you kind of got, you know, little friendships going with people you never would think you'd talk to. For example, the man who holds Michael Jackson's umbrella.
Yeah.
I tell a little story at the end of the book about him, this sort of fierce-looking man, you know, looks very mean and big with the umbrella. And one day he came up and just started talking to me in this very soft little gentle voice, and I thought to myself, wow, Michael Jackson's umbrella man is talking to me, you know? What planet am I living on?
Yeah, the fact that a Michael Jackson has an umbrella man indicates it's a different planet than most of us live on. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Diane Diamond. Her book is called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case.
Now, Paul, can I just ask you, did you get that title? I'm afraid maybe I was a little too obtuse in it.
I took it as Be Careful Who You Love, as the message that Michael was sending to the world, that it's part of that whole, I'm completely innocent, this was all fun, and it's as if he is saying, well, you know, be careful who you love, because it may come back to haunt you. Is that what you meant?
Well, sort of. It's a line from Billie Jean, from the song he wrote, Billie Jean. And in there, it says, my mama always told me, be careful who you love.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was good advice for everybody, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also good advice for us. And the celebrities that we put up there on pedestals and we sort of turn the other way when they misbehave or do things that society doesn't think is right, we still adore them. And I think maybe we need to take another look at that and see how that bright light of celebrity blinds us and blinds them, too. They feel, and I'm not talking just about Michael Jackson, but a lot of them, that they don't have to play by the rest of society's rules. They can behave in a different way.
Well, that's the American culture of celebrity, and one that seems to have run away with far too many people, both on the celebrity side and on the public side. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
What about the family? As I'm reading through the book here, and you talk about some of them being in the courtroom every day and some of them only showing up at the beginning and the end, do they believe that he's innocent, or does it not matter to them because he's the gravy train?
Well, or was the gravy train. I think maybe the train is pulled out of that station. You know, I'll tell you, I have an awful lot of sources that are close to the family. I even have contact with some of the family through email and other things. They will tell you in public that Michael is a victim, that he has been victimized by the man, Tom Snedden, the DA, and, you know, everybody from A to Z. But privately, their friends and their associates that they talk to tell me that they were surprised it took this long to get Michael Jackson in court.
Hmm.
I was sitting right behind LaToya, her mother, Janet Jackson, when the verdicts were being read. And if I could have bottled the look on LaToya's face, LaToya, of course, is the one who came out years ago and said, my brother has a problem with little boys, and then she recanted it.
And then blamed it on her then-husband.
Right, Jack Gordon, who's since passed away. But the look on her face as that 10, not guilty, not guilty, and she turned around to look at her mother, and her face, her jaw just fell open like, can you believe this? You know, later they all said, oh, we cried tears of joy at every not guilty. Well, I only saw their mother crying. But I think to them, many of them thought this was maybe going to be the end for their brother, that he would go to prison.
Is the reason that this case didn't go through because of the mother of the accused boy?
In large part, I think if the state had given that jury any reason to like that mother, the outcome may have been different. They just didn't like her at all.
Mm.
But I think more important than that, Paul, is they just, most of them, adored Michael Jackson.
And they couldn't get past that? I mean, shouldn't that come out in the voir dire and the vetting of the jurors?
Oh, boy, I'm glad you said that. Because the judge in this case, Judge Rodney Melville, said, in effect, we're going to run this case like any other case. Okay, come on. We're not going to have 100 pages in the jury questionnaire. No, we're only going to have 40 questions. You got more questions you can ask them during voir dire. That's the part where you get to ask the jurors questions. The lawyers get to ask questions. Then the voir dire rolled around, and he only gave them 5 minutes. 5 minutes with each potential juror. Come on, we're going to run this like every other trial. Well, you know and I know, once you put a celebrity into the mix, now put a superstar celebrity in the mix, it's not like a normal trial. You got to know more about these jurors, and I think it's clear now that three of the jurors came out afterward and said, there were a whole bunch of Michael Jackson fans in that room. We felt coerced into voting the way we did.
Mm.
We think he's guilty. So that's a bad verdict for everybody, for the state and for Michael, because it doesn't exonerate him. In fact, it just casts more doubt on him.
The book is called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. More with Diane Diamond in just a moment as the Paul Harris Show continues here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Michael Jackson's Billie Jean, one of the lyrics from that song, is the title of Diane Diamond's book, Be Careful Who You Love. Inside the Michael Jackson Case. She covered it originally in 1993. She was the only reporter at the Neverland Ranch when they went to do the search of the place in November of 2003. You had that story to yourself that day, didn't you, Diane?
Yeah, I did. A quirk of fate in probably the summer, July-ish of 2003, rather. I heard from a source. I always stay in touch with my sources. Always send Christmas and birthday cards, I learned. And I got a phone call that said, there's another kid. I said, you're kidding. No, there's going to be another raid on Neverland. And I said, well, I want to be there when it happens. And I got to be.
And what happened that day inside? I mean, you didn't have access to the inside like they did, but what have you found out happened inside the house that day? Was Jackson there?
No, Jackson wasn't there. About 70, it was about 8:30 in the morning. Beautiful countryside out there, 2,700-acre estate. And all of a sudden, down this dusty road, old Figueroa Mountain Road is the name of it, comes this convoy of 70 cars, trucks, forensic vans, and boom, they went right into Neverland, lickety-split, and they didn't come out till midnight. Michael was not there. He actually was in Las Vegas in a villa, a very, very fancy name for a very fancy suite at the Mirage Hotel, where he'd been holed up for a couple of weeks. He was supposed to be doing a video for a CD box release, but he never got the video done. And sources there at the Mirage Hotel in the villa section, this is where all the big, you know, movie stars and famous people stay, told me that he'd been holed up there for a couple of weeks with, quote, a bunch of little boys.
Mm.
And they came and they went, and most of them were German, and they would come outside into the breezeway and smoke cigarettes and yell in German into their cell phones. But this one particular source said to me, toward the end of the second week and into the third week of this massive party, Michael Jackson was not allowing any maids or butlers or anybody to come into the suite. They would just bring food and leave it on a tray, or, you know, cigarettes or whatever they ordered up. And at the end of this 3 weeks, of course, Neverland is raided, and the whole bunch of them decamp, and the staff got to go in and finally clean out this room. $30,000 worth of damage.
Mm.
There were trays of rotting food and broken liquor bottles and cigarettes stubbed out on leather couches and chairs, and it was just a horrific mess.
Could any of that evidence be used in the trial against him?
Well, it didn't come up at trial at all. It was really not relevant as to where he was the day they raided the...
But if they knew he was in there with other boys...
Yeah, well, prove he's doing something wrong. Yeah. Is there a victim? Does anyone want to come forward and say, hey, he did something wrong to me? That's the problem. There's never, or very rarely, anybody who comes forward and says, something wrong happened, and I'm willing to take it all the way to court.
And I guess that would have to be the parents, and these are the same parents who were letting their kids play with Michael Jackson in the first place.
Right, right. Again, I go back to my FBI profiler who said, you know, always remember, because that's my big question. I'm a mother. How in the world do you let this happen to your kid? And he told me, you know, these people are really, really slick. They don't go after Ozzy and Harriet families. They go after families where the parents are needy or divorced or maybe have an emotional problem, and they really seduce the parents first.
Seduce in terms of celebrity and money? Was there cash going from one person to the next?
In Michael Jackson's case, there were always, let's hop on a corporate jet and go to Disneyland. Let's go to Monaco. Let's go to Las Vegas. You know, gifts, gifts, gifts.
Mm.
It is enough to blind even the best of us.
Why wasn't that FBI agent you've mentioned a couple of times, Ken Lanning, why wasn't he allowed to testify in the trial?
Well, again, the judge ruled in this case that his testimony was not relevant. He would have come forward and testified about grooming, how molesters groom their children. But the door to that subject was not opened. I'm really breaking down a really legal, complex legal thing here for you. But he just didn't allow the lawyers to go into that subject matter, which is too bad, because I don't think in this country we understand we really don't want to talk about child molesting.
Mm.
We hope it doesn't happen, and we don't want to hear about it when it does, and I think we really need to have a dialogue in this country as to how it happened.
But maybe if the jury had heard this guy, I mean, he wrote, you say that this is the guy who wrote the FBI's handbook on this, the Child Molester Handbook for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Maybe if the jury had heard him just talking about what a child molester is and how they act and what they do, it could have broken through that celebrity facade that was covering up the eyes of these jurors.
Well, you see, this is what I tried to do in the book, is to establish the pattern of behavior. And that's exactly what Ken Lanning talks about in his profile, is here is the pattern that of a pedophile. This is how they behave. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And as I went back and reconstructed everything from 93 to 2003 and beyond, there is this pattern of behavior of Michael Jackson's that is, seems to fit that profile. Now again, you know, this jury found him not guilty. And so we have to keep saying that because in the eyes of the law, he's not guilty.
Mm.
But it was really disturbing to finally sit down and put it all together and say, wow.
Yeah. You mentioned when he was in Vegas, all these people who were working for or around him or hotel employees. He had lots of employees at Neverland Ranch. Two or three years ago, I interviewed a guy named Robert Wegner, who was the head of security at Neverland in the early 90s. He self-published a little 90-100-page book and told of some of his experiences there. I think he was trying to cash in on the trial going on at the time, but he had some interesting stories, and so I had him on. Why aren't there real insiders in the Jackson camp, or not even insiders, but people who worked at Neverland, who have come forward and said, yes, I saw the Jesus juice in the room with Michael and these boys?
Well, they did come forward and say that at the trial. But the question is, why didn't they come forward? If they thought something was terribly wrong between Michael Jackson and boys, why didn't they go to the cops and report it?
That's what I mean.
The answer is, some of them did. Some of them did, and they were so roundly vilified and crushed under the boot heel of Team Jackson that they're still smarting from it. One in particular, a man named Ralph Chacon. Now, Team Jackson will tell you, oh, yeah, he tried to sue Michael for, you know, wrongful termination, and he stole all this stuff from Neverland. And, well, they found some candy bars with Neverland wrappers on them. I mean, that was really about it.
Mm-hmm.
But this man, and I write about it in the book, he saw what he said was a sex act between Michael Jackson and a young boy. Saw it through a window, saw it with his own eyes, saw it happen in the middle of the night at Neverland. And he passed not one, but two lie detector tests. But you see, we're back, Paul, to where's the victim? The victim and his family would not allow him to testify, so there's no case.
The book is called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Diane Diamond here on the Paul Harris Show. We're back in just a moment on KMOX. Talking with investigative reporter Diane Diamond, who worked on Hard Copy in 1993 when the first Michael Jackson child molestation case broke. 10 years later, she followed up with the real trial against Michael Jackson, the one that he was acquitted in out in Santa Barbara, California. She writes about all of this in her new book called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Think Michael Jackson will ever sell music in the United States again, Diane?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, many of the songs that you know and hum along with every day still bring in residual money for him. Is he going to write any new music? I don't think, I think his best days are behind him.
He can't possibly tour again, can he?
I don't think so. His health is such that, I mean, he was so frail at the end of that trial. And you know, again, he's 47 years old, and he certainly isn't, you know, part of the Rolling Stones. And at 47, most rock and rollers or pop singers, you know, kind of fade into oblivion. He's got a lot more baggage than just his age, you know.
Is he broke?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people say that I'm not being fair when I say that because he's getting all these millions in and Beatles songs, residuals, and all of that. But I'll tell you something. The Beatles catalog that he owns, about half of it, is mortgaged at least $200 million. If he sells it, when he sells it, it's worth about $200 or $300 million. I mean, he's not going to realize what he otherwise would have if he hadn't he mortgaged Neverland. Neverland, at last I looked, had, oh, gosh, I think it was like a $19 million lien on it, you know, so he could sell it for $20 million. That's peanuts in that world, not to you and me, of course.
Right, but he owes lots of money to Sony Music. And
he's got a big balloon payment coming up in December, as a matter of fact. And if he doesn't make it, he's going to have to sell the Beatles catalog. He's going to have to sell Neverland, probably at a loss. I was stunned, Paul, during the trial. This is not a man, for all the money he's made in his life, he has, as far as we learned, no mutual funds, no stocks and bonds, no real estate, you know, major real estate holdings. He doesn't have apartment buildings or anything. He has Neverland. He put all of his money, or most all of his money, into Neverland.
And yet, even when he was going broke because of his extravagant lifestyle, he was still going out and going on these lavish shopping trips, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was part of the Bashir documentary. Remember that?
He
went to the Vegas store and spent $100,000 in 20 minutes. And then when you go back and you check, see, this is the theme, another theme running through the book, I think. The Team Jackson thinks if they say something often enough, everyone will accept it as the truth. So Michael Jackson has a lot of money and he can go out and spend $100,000 in 20 minutes. But when you check, you find out that he never paid that bill. So it really was all for the cameras and all for show. And frankly, so much of his life, there are revelations in the book about his childhood that no one has really heard before. And from the youngest age, he has been taught that public relations is king.
Yep.
That you, if you say it often enough, people will just believe that you are the king of pop.
He doesn't live in Neverland anymore. I don't even think he lives in the United States, does he?
No. I mean, legally, he's still a United States resident, but he lives in Bahrain, in this little island nation of Bahrain. He's the guest of a prince who I believe is paying all of his bills. You might have heard that he bought some property in Bahrain. I don't think so. I think the prince probably bought that for him or is letting him use this property. And they don't have an extradition treaty with America. So if he gets himself in hot water back here, he can't be extradited from Bahrain.
I want to ask you about two of these boys in particular, and you even have pictures of them in the book here, Brett Barnes and Wade Robeson, who were 10 or 11 years old in 1993 and were Jackson's playmates, let's call them. And they, in 2003 and 2004, testified for the defense in the jury. Now, I'm sure the prosecutor was looking at these guys and saying, hey, you know what? You're going to be evidence for us. This is going to be a good thing for us because, you know, you came out in 93 and admitted that he slept with you and on and on and on. But that kind of backfired on him, didn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, they were called as witnesses for Michael Jackson. And interestingly enough, these two now 20-something young men are both from Australia. They were both staying out at Neverland during the trial.
Oh.
Still enjoying the largesse of Mr. Jackson, but they came forward and said nothing ever happened. But on cross-examination, when the DA's team gets up, they admit, yes, I slept with him a lot. One kid admitted that he slept 365 days straight in a year with him, and at the time he was 11. There's a picture of him in the book, little teeny tiny kid, dark hair, looked very much like the current accuser, looked very much like the 1993 accuser.
Yeah.
They both said on the stand that nothing bad ever happened, but on cross-examination, they got so tied up in their stories and became so sort of nervous on the stand that two of the jurors afterward told me, we didn't believe a word that those two said, or Macaulay Culkin. They didn't believe Macaulay Culkin, that nothing ever happened with him. They didn't believe that either.
What's the deal with Debbie Rowe? What's she up to?
Oh, Debbie. You know, this is the most unlikely bride for Michael Jackson you can ever imagine. She's a big gal. She rides Harley Davidson motorcycles. She drinks tequila. She cusses a blue streak. She even slipped up on the stand and some curse words came out. She's a real tough cookie, you know. But she told a source of mine that when she took the stand and she looked out at Michael Jackson, who she hadn't seen in years, she hadn't seen her children in years. They don't know that she is the mother. She said, I looked at how thin he was and how pale he was, and I felt so sorry for him, I just couldn't say anything bad about him.
Oh.
So
yeah.
that really blew up in the prosecution's face.
And what about the other Mrs. Jackson, Lisa Marie Presley Jackson Cage, or whatever her name is now?
Yeah, you notice she didn't come around the trial.
No. Did you ever talk to her?
No, I tried to. I have tried to. We have some people, mutual acquaintances that we both know, but I've never spoken to her directly. She's another tough cookie, though. She's really tough. And the last interview she did with an author named J. Randy Tarabarelli, he's written a terrific a whole biography of the whole Jackson family. She just said point blank, that was the biggest mistake I ever made, marrying him.
There's an understatement.
Yeah. Well, she went from her daddy, the king of rock and roll, to the king of pop, and she said, I realize now it was a stupid move.
Yeah, pop goes the weasel. Well, Diane, I hope Team Jackson doesn't come after you too hard on this one. Knowing what they've done to you in the past and how they've gone after you in the past, I know that writing things like this and coming out and talking about it even more puts you right in the line of fire for them. But you're the one who's been there all along telling these stories, and I thank you for taking some time today to share them with me here on KMOX.
Oh, my pleasure, and such good questions. I appreciate it.
Thank you. The book is called Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case. Diane Diamond here on The Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.